We hear it a lot these days. Read to your kids. They need the language. They need to practice reading. But that's just one star in a constellation of language exposure children need when very young. It makes a big, big difference in how a child's brain develops, it turns out. Our guest today lays out the magic number, 30 million words. A book by that name is now out in hardcover book form. Dana Suskind, MD, is professor of surgery and pediatrics at the University of Chicago School of Medicine, and she is the founder and co-director of the 30 Million Words Initiative there. She was on an advisory committee for the Too Small to Fail initiative of the Clinton Foundation and was part of the Obama administration's focus on closing the achievement gap in young students. Dana Suskind, thanks so much for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you so much for having me.
You can certainly anticipate the first question and do in the subtitle of your first chapter. Why did a pediatric cochlear implant surgeon become a social scientist?
That's a great question. Actually, it was my work as a cochlear implant surgeon that really led me in my work and my work with my patients that really led me into this amazing journey. Do you want me to tell you the story a
bit?
Yes,
please, yes.
So a cochlear implant, as many of your listeners know, is an awesome piece of technology that allows a child born deaf the ability to hear, to learn how to talk, and really to learn on grade level. And I started the pediatric cochlear implant program at the University of Chicago Medicine probably about 9 years ago. And started noticing pretty early on these huge differences in outcomes in terms of learning how to talk and read amongst my patients, even though they came to me with very equal potentials for learning how to talk. And what I found was that some children, after implantation, would be talking and reading on par with their hearing peers, while others would barely be able to communicate. And that difference, tragically, almost always fell along socioeconomic lines. And it was that experience that really, you know, pushed me out of the operating room and, I always say, into the world of social sciences, because in truth, you know, your work as a physician and as a surgeon shouldn't end, you know, after you finish the surgery. It's really when your patients do well. And I was lucky enough to, you know, be at the University of Chicago, where there are so many smart people, who really opened my eyes to the fact that the differences that I was seeing amongst my patients actually had nothing to do with their hearing loss, but really the world in which they had been born, and specifically how much language they were being exposed to. Along my journey, I learned about this very famous study that the book takes its name from, by Betty Hart and Todd Risley, that found that children born into poverty, not all children, of course, will have heard 30 million fewer words than their more affluent peers. And just that difference in how many words and the quality of the language predicted not only their vocabulary, with them knowing half the vocabulary, but really IQ and test scores in the third grade. So just the differences in how and how much parents were talking to their kids really started the educational trajectories of these kids.
So we're not just talking a difference in vocabulary, we're talking a difference in what the actual structure of the brain does, is that right?
Absolutely. You know, I think that many of us don't realize, because, you know, all these little kids are so cute and cuddly, that really in the first 3 years of life, there is 80 to 85% of our brain growth, our physical brain growth occurs. I mean, so inside that cuddly newborn is this intellectual core that's just waiting for language and interaction to come in to help build that brain. Because the brain, unlike our heart and lungs, isn't fully formed at birth. It really is reliant on what happens in those first 3 years.
It's amazing to think in those terms. But you were talking about the cochlear implants, though, and the differences. And you point out, just to make this really clear to people, you cite a case much later in the book about a 20-year-old who had been deaf, I think, all of his life, and his parents wanted a cochlear implant for you, thinking that he'd be able to talk pretty much as soon as it was in. But you had a different take on it. What was your take?
Yeah, well, it really comes down to something called the critical language period. As many of us, you know, realize, it's hard to learn a language later on in life. And it's because your brain is set up to learn language easily and almost, you know, second naturedly in these first few years of life. So the story about Muhammad was that he was born deaf. He was an incredibly bright human being, you know, who was able to sign. And he wanted to be able to hear, which a cochlear implant would allow him to do. but the ability to develop spoken language, because he had missed what's called the critical language period, would be incredibly difficult, if not almost impossible.
So the critical language period runs from what age to what age?
It's really in the first, 3 to 5 years of life, but it doesn't mean that it's ever too late. I mean, certainly my children are learning, new languages in high school and in middle school. But the point is that because of the brain's what's called neuroplasticity, meaning the ability to learn something new easily, it's really the first few years where it happens most easily. So that's why you've got to get that language in early.
You know, it's interesting because we have neuroplasticity, the ability of the brain to do some compensation and flexing in a sense. But then you also say in the book that brain and neural structures are generally unforgiving. And you mean that in a physical sense? They just don't repair easily?
Yeah, I mean, it's in the physical and the functional sense. I mean, as you, and science, the beauty of science is that it's really hopefully pushing, the boundaries much further. But, so neural structures, if you have a spinal cord injury and you become paralyzed, regaining that ability, is incredibly, there's scientists working on it, but we haven't cracked that nut. And in the same way, a stroke is unforgiving. Neurologic structures are unforgiving. But the beauty is that when a child is born deaf, if you get that language in early, because hearing is not about the ear, it's really about the brain. The ear just sort of transmits the signal. And so hearing loss is one of the few neurologic issues that can be easily fixed early on.
All right, we can fix the ears, but then the brain has to be able to interpret what it's pulling in here. One of the many concepts in the book, 30 Million Words, Building a Child's Brain. Dr. Dana Suskind at the University of Chicago is our guest on The Exchange, the creator of the initiative and the book. We'll come back and talk more with her, and you can join us with your comments and questions and phone calls and emails when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 25. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Dr. Dana Suskind at the University of Chicago School of Medicine. She is the founder and co-director of the 30 Million Words Initiative there. And she's written a book called 30 Million Words, Building a Child's Brain. Tune in, talk more, take turns. The idea being that it takes a lot of words to get a child's brain to develop well. Just marinate that child in language is the basic message. We'll get more specific as we go through. And you can join this conversation on The Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So, Dana, it sounds like you really don't get a second chance to make a good first impression on a brain. You got to do this right the first time.
It's a beautiful way to put it. I think that the point is that doing it right the first time is so much easier than going back to try to fix it.
So does the 30 million words, based on what you said before, the 30 million words is the difference between kids who are okay and kids whose brains develop well? I mean, it's not, basically you need a lot more than 30 million words, I think is what I'm hearing.
Yeah, and the 30 million words is really just a metaphor for differences in quality, differences in back and forth conversation, differences in, affirmations versus prohibitions, don't do that. So it's really, it's much more, it's a much richer sort of idea. And so that's really why we, the three T's, is the core to building a rich language environment. It's not just, spew vocabulary at your child. It's tuning into your child's interests. It's talking about it. It's taking turns and really looking at viewing your child as a conversational partner. So,
you mentioned already Betty Hart and Todd Risley, who actually created the term through their own research. Their investigation was born of failure, you point out. What had they tried to do?
Well, what's amazing to me is their interest in the 0 to 3 period really came out of their work in the preschool period. And I want to say I am a firm believer in preschool for, and a big believer in it. But what they found is that they were doing preschool work, preschool interventions, really trying to work with children from low-income backgrounds to with vocabulary interventions. And what they found was that there was fade out, that initially it looked like these kids were doing better, but there was fade out. And so that made them realize, like, what is going on beforehand? Why has the foundation not been set early on? And that's what we're seeing. And that's why they started their landmark study. And what they found was a huge part of the answer, that really this early language environment was building the brain foundation to allow future learning. And so our whole focus on preschool for all is incredibly important. I want to say that over and over again. But unless we also include and aggressively address the 0 to 3 period, it's, always going to be catch up rather than prevention.
They did not pull the 30 million figure out of the air. How painstaking was their work at measuring child's exposure to language?
You realize how technology has helped science so much. I mean, they spent 3 years following these children and their families from all different walks of life, going into their homes, recording what was being said, analyzing it. But then they had to spend another 3 years transcribing and counting and looking at it in detail, because, that was before, super fast computers. I mean, probably with the technology we have now, it would be done, in a few weeks' time. So, but because of their perseverance, really they opened up our eyes to the importance of language.
Now, there is a backdrop here. Can you tell us about the Chomsky versus Skinner debate on language that you raise in the book?
Oh, wow. You've really gotten into it. I mean, so what's very interesting is that prior to Hart and Risley, there's always been interest in sort of language development of young children, right? Because it's a miraculous thing that in, 3 years' time, all of a sudden children can speak the native tongue of their world. And before Hart and Risley, there was Chomsky and Skinner. Chomsky was of the belief that we have sort of a language acquisition device, that you were born with something internally that allowed you to develop all this language. It's sort of the nature part of the argument. Whereas Skinner, who was believed in sort of operant conditioning, that it was experience that helped children learn language, but ironically it was sort of a it wasn't so much input or differences in input, but sort of like operant conditioning. And so what was interesting is there was this huge debate on how children learn language, one being Skinner and the other side being Chomsky, and neither of them really looked at differences in input, which I thought was very interesting. They only looked at sort of the typical middle-class child and sort of how they learned at the most fundamental level. And what Hart and Risley did, and many others subsequently, have really shown that the differences in input have a huge impact on how children learn language, which makes sense.
Differences in input, and it's not just quantity either, as you've already alluded to a bit. What else does it take in here?
Yeah, I mean, quantity is just one part of it. It's really quality of language. It's the back and forth. It's the richness of vocabulary. Even, a parent talking about the past and the future has a particular brain-building ability. So it's really differences in types of language. I go into, in the fourth chapter, which was one of my favorite chapters, that, language builds your math ability and your spatial ability. So I always joke that maybe I became a surgeon because my mom and dad used a lot of spatial language. Even our ability to self-regulate and our control of our behavior, our generosity, it all can be traced back at some level. I don't want to say it's everything, but at some level to how our parents talked and interacted with us.
Now, interaction is a major point here. So anybody who thinks that they're just going to bathe their child in words by parking them in front of the TV or by talk radio or something, it does not have the same effect, right?
It doesn't, although I'm sure talk radio is much better than TV. I say that on the television, on the radio.
Of course.
No, it's really, that's That's the key. I wish that television grew, you know, and remember, I'm talking about the 0 to 3 space. I'm not talking older right now. Television doesn't help grow babies' brains. It doesn't help build their vocabulary. And why is that? I mean, our brains and our language development really came out of the need for human interaction. And as a result, that's what our brains expect and need to grow to their fullest potential. Because I think we have to keep reminding ourselves that our brains, we come out with brains that are not finished. They're undeveloped. You know, our heart and lungs are fully formed. Our brains aren't. It relies for in all this information coming in, this language coming in. So that's why TV doesn't work. That's why talk radio probably works. But it's why ultimately we need warm, caring, interactive human beings at the helm.
Our guest is Dr. Dana Suskin. She's a professor of surgery and pediatrics at the University of Chicago School of Medicine. She's written a book based on her initiative, 30 Million Words, Building a Child's Brain. Tune in, talk more, take turns. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about just how important language is early in life to the growth of the brain itself. 800-838-3760 by phone, jx@jeffnet.org. By email. Let's go to Jacob in Springfield. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Dr. Dana Suskin.
Hi, good morning. Dr. Suskin, I want to introduce a separate number to your 30 million, and it's the number two. And consider this, a baby needs two parents to raise it versus growing up in a single parent household. We see this predominantly, for instance, in Chicago and black family dysfunction. Up to 80% of black kids grew up without a father. I mean, Obama was one of them. And up to 60% of poor white children do as well. And we see that they grow up and they have less opportunities. They're more deprived. They're poor. The mothers are stressed. You know, they don't have enough time for them. They don't read to them. And the kids grow up with discipline problems and they have a higher rate of being incarcerated as adults and having higher rates of mental illness. So I 30 million is a great number, and it's a round figure, but just having two parents, that's the natural way that kids grew up. And I think take away a father figure, and you're going to end up with bad childhoods and parental dysfunction.
All right, let's see what the research shows up in that here. Jacob, thanks for that. Appreciate it. Dana, what you got on there?
So I would say two things. It actually takes a village. And I think that's the whole point of the book and the initiative, is that all of this can't fall on the shoulder of one or two people. Really, all of our children of this country should be our children. And we need to approach it that way. And so I think that, you know, community and families are incredibly important for, you know, building our future.
The concept, though, of who's giving remarks from parents. There is some stuff in the book about positive and negative remarks from parents. How do those figure into the process?
Yeah, so there's, you know, I think one of the most powerful aspects of the Hart and Risley study was actually the differences in, you know, affirmations versus prohibitions, the don't do that, get down versus explaining to grow your child's brain. And that difference was profoundly different along socioeconomic lines, although certainly it's not all parents use directives at different points. And you sort of think about how that impacts not just learning, right? Because when you use a directive, get down, that's about three words. It's not bathing your child in language, but also how they view themselves in this and what they're able to do. So we really try to change directives into encouragements because you build a lot more brain connections and a lot more self-esteem.
I imagine a few people are going to think this starts to leak into the realm of making sure you're being positive, even when that's not necessarily what's called for. Are we talking about getting into the, like, everybody gets a medal for showing up kind of thought?
No, actually, you know what? I talk about the fact that, in fact, the self-esteem movement failed. So the fact that science is really important for what we discuss, and science is behind everything we talk about. But, in fact, you're alluding to different types of encouragements for children. And it actually, my learning this research actually impacted how I interacted with my children. There's something called process versus person-based praise. So, you know, just imagine your toddler or your three-year-old is working on a puzzle, and all of a sudden he or she got it, and you're so excited, and you want to praise them. And, you know, your natural instinct, I mean, including myself, is like, oh, you are so smart. But there's actually a flip side to that. Another way you could praise them is, wow, I loved how hard you were working on it. And what is the difference between those two and the impact on the child? It's really quite interesting. When you use person-based praise, you are so smart, what it does is that it actually can impact the children's ability to persevere through other challenges. Because, you know, now he thinks, wow, if I can't get this puzzle the next time, it must be because I'm not so smart. So he actually will quit and sort of pull away. Whereas if you said, wow, I loved how hard you worked on that puzzle, he'll persevere next time, because when it's hard, he'll know it's a matter of hard work. And so this person versus process-based praise, you know, learning about that for myself, actually, you know, so now with my son, I'm like, wow, I love how you took the table, the plates off the table, although it doesn't always happen.
Must be a teenager.
Yes, how'd you know?
Wild guess. Let's take a call here. We have John in Grants Pass on the line. We're talking about 30 million words with Dana Suskind. Welcome to The Exchange, John.
Thank you. Sorry I call all the time, but so I want your guest's opinion on my grandson, who's 5 and a half, has mild to moderate autism. That means that he used to get so upset if there was a puzzle piece missing, kind of stays to himself, and has difficulty with some of the physical functions of life. But, man, is he smart. He knows at five, he knows every state and state capital. So, can you tell me what's going on in his brain? Thanks.
Oh, you know what? I wish I was an expert in this area. Certainly, I take care of many children with autism, and I would, you know, but I would be doing you a disservice if I went into what I do know, because there are many people who know so, so much more. But I always think, you know, with all children, it's always about emphasizing their strengths. And I think that's incredible that he knows, you know, all his states and the state capitals, because certainly I know only very few. But hopefully you'll have the next guest who's an expert in autism. So forgive me.
All right. Thanks for that. Tim in Eureka, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Dana Suskind.
Hi, what a great guest. You know, I wanted to say that the mother-infant bond is a force of nature. I get to work with the 0 to 3 population and assess these kids, and it really feels like so much development radiates from that bond.
Yeah.
I also want to promote the research on spontaneous infant symbolic gesturing, otherwise known as baby signs, when these little 9-month to 16-month-olds can have a couple dozen vocabulary terms in terms of their spontaneous gestures. It's not necessarily American Sign Language. It's baby sign language. The little guy makes it up himself, and you become aware of it and participate with him.
Interesting stuff. Thanks for bringing that up, Tim.
Yeah.
And Dana, what can you tell us?
Absolutely. You are talking about incredibly important science. So you're seeing it in action. I mean, first in terms of the parent-child bond. I mean, you talked the mother-child bond, but certainly father-child bond is incredibly powerful. It's the foundation to which all the language learning occurs. You know, without that bond, language, you know, it doesn't stick. And in fact, you know, in our programs, especially in the early, you know, the perinatal period, we really talk about the 3 T's and the strategies of 30 million words, but in the context of attachment. So we're big believers in that and couldn't agree more. In terms of the symbolic gesture, you know, that too is incredibly important, you know, because, you know, the name of the book is 30 million words. It makes you think it's just about spoken language. Really, it's all language. And one of, as I mentioned, the 3 T's, the tune in, talk more, take turns, which are critical for a rich language environment. Take turns means that when you view your baby as a conversational partner, it's not that you're waiting for him to give you a fully formed word, we'd wait forever, but that you respond to every symbolic gesture, to every coo, to every glance, you know, to every burp. So yes, I couldn't agree more, and your beliefs are based in science. So,
The speed of language processing, this is a pretty interesting part of this. I mean, and so it begins to firm up at some point. I mean, it's sort of like they get the one language that they're generally is their mother tongue. Is that it? And then kind of eliminate the rest?
Yeah, so it's super interesting. So are you talking about Patricia Kuhl's or Anne Fernald's work?
I think either one or both.
Okay. So, I mean, I think that, you know, I talk about, you know, this is pretty, you know, intense science that we're translating, hopefully into very accessible ways. But the way a baby learns language is really, it's a window into brain development. Because babies are born, you know, if, you know, any of us know that we can't hear all the sounds of a language. I mean, we go to China and I can't hear all the tones when I try to say it. Or if you hear somebody from Japan trying to see some of the English letters, you know that they don't hear it anymore, no matter how many times you repeat it. And there's a reason for it, because your brain, when it's first born, can hear all the sounds of the world's language. Patricia Kuhl, a very famous scientist, calls it, you know, being a citizen of the world. But as you sort of go into your native tongue, you stop being able to hear those sounds. And that's why you become, you know, expert in your own tongue and not everybody else's tongue.
All right. Dana Suskin's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Her initiative, her book, both called 30 Million Words. It's about building a child's brain. We'll come back and talk more with Dana. Take more of your phone calls and emails when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 10. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking today with Dr. Dana Suskin from University of Chicago Medicine. She is the founder and co-director of the 30 Million Words Initiative, which now appears in book form. 30 Million Words, Building a Child's Brain, subtitled Tune In, Talk More, Take Turns, a key part of that. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about the importance of lots of language at an early age for the development of a child's brain. 800-838-3760 by phone if you'd like to join the conversation. By email, jx@jeffnet.org. And I guess what it gets down to, is there anything else besides language, Dana, that figures so prominently in brain development?
You know, it is absolutely the fundamental nutrition for the growing brain. But remember, it's not, again, just words. It's really the lens into the whole parent-child relationship, because most of our relationship comes through language. So it's, you know, ultimately that connection.
All right, let's take another call here. Let's go to George in Wairika. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Dr. Dana Suskin.
Pardon me. Thank you very much for the subject. I find it fascinating. There seems to be one thing that doesn't come through. Everything she says, I believe, is absolutely true. However, the genesis of all of this is whether the child, whether it's a human child or a feral cat, is wanted. If it's not wanted, his chances or their chances of growing up anywhere near success are virtually non-existent. You'll find those people at the basis of most crime. And if they are wanted and interacted with, whether it's an animal that isn't feral or human, they have the chance of making it. That's when the two-parent thing is not necessarily paramount, but the fact that somebody can actually have a child and not have it impinge on their ability to survive in this society. Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks, George. Appreciate it. Any thoughts on that, Dana?
So, you know, it's very interesting. I mean, most of my work, you know, is in Chicago, on the south side of Chicago. And what I've come to realize is that no socioeconomic group has cornered the market on loving their children nor wanting their children to be happy and successful. I mean, literally. I mean, the families we partner with are enthusiastic beyond enthusiastic. So with that being said, you know, the impacts of poverty, you know, living in a high crime neighborhood, not having enough to eat, not having adequate child care, you know, absolutely those things can impact, I mean, any of us in our bandwidth to talk and interact. So I've not yet seen any child that I've interacted with whose parent doesn't want absolutely the best for their child. And I say that absolutely 100%. You know, and that's why this initiative is not just about, like, you know, go talk to your kid. You know, that's an important part. But it's also about us understanding and supporting families and investing in families so they can invest in their children, because you can't get around it. These children are the future of our country, right? 50% of them all of them. And, you know, unless we invest in the right way, it's not just the individual who loses out, but our country.
Society at large, for sure. Sandy in Mount Shasta, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Dana Suskind.
Yeah, hi. Very good show. I work with young children, so this is really important to me. An earlier caller talked about the conditions of some, he made the point of saying black children grow up under in places like Chicago and such. And I was kind of disturbed because I thought, I wouldn't call him a racist, but I thought his comments sort of reflected an ignorance of the kind of institutionalized racism that's gone on in this country for so long that has resulted in those children living in those conditions in the first place. And as your guest said, it takes a village to raise children. And that was the norm for about 99% of the time humans have been on the planet. The two-parent household is a pretty recent development. And there are sociological and socioeconomic reasons for those deprived conditions of those poor families in Europe. And they range from the fact that from slavery onward, black families have been blocked from accumulating real wealth, with some exceptions, and that redlining practices of keeping people to certain neighborhoods have also resulted in conditions.
Sandy, I'm sorry. Can you move your phone closer to your mouth or something? It's really kind of muffled.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's a little better.
Were you able to hear what I've said so far?
Yeah, that's good.
Okay. Is that better?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, this results in all. We look at our social problems in this country. It's so frustrating. We look at them as though they somehow magically arose by themselves, and we don't put them in the context that would help explain why a certain category of people are having an extremely difficult time even taking care of the basic needs of their children, much less their education. That's all I wanted to say.
All right, thanks for that. So let's talk about the investments you talked about, Dana, about the kinds of things we do to help people in society. I mean, what kinds of investments are we talking about?
So I think this is really, you know, it comes down to, if you understand the science and you understand that parents are the key architects of children's brain development, I mean, it's not, you know, you can't do a formula switch out, that we really need to sort of understand the ways to support all families, and especially families that may not have the same resources, so they can do what every parent wants to do, give their child the best chance in life. And obviously, you know, this book goes into it a little bit towards the end. This book is really about understanding the brain science so you can understand why we need to make these important investments. But, you know, stable child care, you know, work stability, education of parents, for me, is an early childhood initiative. You know, I'm all about the children, but you can't be all about the children unless we figure out ways to best support parents so they can invest in their children.
We have an email here from Scott, no town given. He says, I thought I heard a reference at the outset, perhaps from Jeff as opposed to Dr. Suskind, to the optimal number of words. I went back and checked. I talked about optimum development, but his point was it might suggest that it would be possible for there to be too many as well as too few words. Is there any evidence that there's an upper limit to the number of words that's beneficial for a young child to hear, or that beyond a certain point it makes no demonstrable difference? He says, I have a relative who chatters at her toddler nonstop. It's exhausting to me to hear it, but the child is incredibly verbal.
That's a great question. Listen, you know, I think that the science is still early. I feel pretty confident that continually talking to your child and never giving him a rest or your arrest is not a good thing. I mean, everybody needs time on their own to explore, to think, to, you know, you know, you need quiet time. So this 30 million words is not about, you know, a world where nobody stops talking. It's really understanding how brains develop and how language is such a key force. We don't know the optimal number, nor do I actually think we ever will, nor do I necessarily think it's important. I think it's just more to know how powerful words are.
And I should point out that it's not 30 million words a day either, so that's something else to think about. Let's take another call here. Go ahead.
Yeah. No, the other thing people often ask me, is it 30 million different words? Which is a great question. It's not. I think they're, you know, we all know, I know about 65,000 words. It's the average for human beings. So 30 million words is just repeated words as well.
Okay. And if is considered a word, we're all in great shape. Another call from Jim in Grants Pass. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. We're talking 30 million words with Dana Suskind.
Yes, good morning. Quick flip side to it. I'm 74 years old. My mother was 29 and a half when I was born. I grew up during World War II. Very few adults around, but older adults. When they said something, I was given time to digest what they said. And when I had a response, they had time to digest how I was responding to it, not just people feeling that white noise with many, many words had to just fill in a space. Loved going on a car trip with long bits of silence. Then when we wanted to comment, it was listened to. Thank you.
All right. Thanks for that, Jim. Appreciate the comments. So the issue of you take on the issue of baby talk in the book and the people who do not wish to baby talk to their kids. Is there a value in baby talk?
Yeah, I would say baby talk gets trashed way too often. Baby talk is actually, and I'm not talking about gaga goo goo nonsense words, but that, you know, melodic tone of, oh, baby, how are you? That type of baby talk, or child-directed speech, as it's called in the world of science, it actually is one of the richest way to build babies' brains, because it gets them interested, it gets them tuned in, as we say, and really kids who hear more baby talk have higher vocabularies. So don't be scared to baby talk with your child. I mean, not with your husband or your dog, or you can do it with your dog, but really with babies, it actually builds brains. I'm glad you think I'm funny.
The other issue is that when we talk about the rhythmic speech, it reminds me of hearing that babies are very good at hearing high tones. And this brings us back to the source of limited controversy we've had in this hour about the two-parent families, whether it's good to have a mix of higher and lower voices uttering the words as well.
You know, I'm not sure that I know if there's science behind that, but there is science showing that both mother's and father's language is incredibly powerful and important. You know, often mothers take a central role, you know, in the interaction, not always with their children, but the science also shows how incredibly important, you know, the male voice as well. So I want to really encourage, you know, male caregivers, fathers, also to interact and talk with their babies. And some of our most enthusiastic participants have been, you know, young dads who, you know, it makes them feel powerful. It makes anybody feel powerful to realize you're an architect of a baby's brain. It's pretty cool. So
it is, to be part of the building process. They're at the ground floor, so to speak. Let's take a call from Heidi in Medford. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Dana Suskind.
Hi. I was going to bring up the story about bilingual children. Mm. My children grew up bilingual. My husband would read to them in English, and I would read to them in German. And when they were little, they really didn't know much the difference when they finally started speaking. Until they were about three and a half, they realized that some people could not understand the language they were speaking at the time. And when they were in America with their grandmother, for instance, they would start babbling in German until they finally understood that person could really not understand that language. When they came back to Germany again, they would speak German and English separately. It was a very interesting phenomenon, and it happened around three and a half.
All right. Thanks for the story, Heidi. Appreciate that. What do you make of that, Dana?
Yeah, I mean, well, she brings up the question of bilingualism and the brain's ability to learn, you know, multiple languages easily. And, you know, certainly, you know, I think it's a wonderful thing. I talk about it in the book and the science related to it. There's actually some interesting science, although, you know, it's a slightly controversial, that maybe even hearing more than one language early on helps in children's executive function or their ability to regulate, and that hearing more than one language actually improves your ability, your executive function. But nonetheless, no matter what, I think it's always a powerful thing to have more than one language and not to shy away from it. And since, you know, very soon we're going to be a majority-minority country, I think, you know, learning Spanish is an awesome thing. So, my children learn Chinese, actually. So.
Oh, wow. Which, Mandarin or Cantonese?
Mandarin.
Right. So I guess the major question then, as people try to figure out what to do with this information, is it once behind, always behind? I mean, if you begin playing catch up with language as an infant, are you always playing catch up?
You know, I want to repeat that, you know, it's never too late. At the same time, you get one chance of building a brain right. You know, will you exactly reach the same potential that you would have, you know, if you don't get the language you need early on? Probably not. And the whole point is that, you know, we're not all the same, but the whole point is that every child deserves the opportunity to reach his or her potential that he or she was genetically, you know, supposed to reach. And that there are too many children in this country who are, we don't even know their potentials. And that's the whole point.
So the steps then, well, you have them right there on the cover of the book. Tune in, talk more, and take turns. So listen to the child, talk to the child, but then also make sure there's interaction. This has got to be a two-way conversation at least part of the time.
You got it. Exactly. The three T's, I always say the three T's will build a rich language environment for everyone and maybe even solve the Middle East crisis.
Wow. We will see about that down the road.
No, maybe not. That's probably overstated.
All right. Really fascinating stuff. The book is called 30 Million Words, Building a Child's Brain. Dr. Dana Suskin is the principal author, and she's been our guest today. Dana, thank you.
Thank you so much.
All right. Take care.